M32. Number 5B.
So that finally, when you come up to the level of science itself, I say science itself, in your consciousness just something resounds at once. Oh, science itself, yes, that's the infinite one. Huh? That's the one and only, that's the I am that I am. Huh? And you suddenly begin to realize, well, then our study must be led up to the point of that I amness. Huh? Just to see there is only one principle ever operative. And so your study leads on and on. I will go over this in much more detail later on when we do something else. But just see, if you looked down these four stages, can you see what the study is? It begins with beliefs and ends with the I am. So here is shown the direction of our study and the intermediate stages that lead up to that. Now, can you see how important it is to have this dimensional sense? Because you know very well from your own experience that actually what you would like to do, what we all like to do, we went all through the same development, that we said, I'm in the world of belief. Actually, I know it's the world of belief. It doesn't work really. It's disastrous. I would like to be in heaven and to be just to have that consciousness which is God. And therefore, we try in one step, to come out of belief and be one with the I am that I am. And that is not possible. See? Can you see? The mystics do the same. The mystics also say, here I am in the world of chaos. Now, if I go and sit on Mount Himalaya and cross my legs and look out into the eternity and wait long enough and get rid of all my beliefs and I put them all away, you know, I'm watching and I'm meditating that nothing disturbs me, that neither the body disturbs me, nor people disturb me, nor suggestions disturb me, nor anything disturb me, then I become one with being. And they never do, or it's a very seldom experience. Science comes and says, well, that is so because there is no method in it that is working. Your method is just first to see actually what are beliefs and what are ideas. How can someone who meditates know what is idea and what is belief? He doesn't know. He himself defines what is a belief and rejects it. But he himself defines it. He has no divine standard according to which he can say what are ideas and what are beliefs. And therefore, by getting rid of beliefs, he can get rid of many things that are not beliefs that are very good. So he has no standard. He cannot even start right. He cannot even in his meditation really check out what is really not right because he doesn't have a standard according to which he can measure what is idea and what is belief. So therefore we need the way of science. And that way of science gently leads up. First says, I first tell you what are ideas and what are beliefs. Then you can separate. When you have separated them and you take only in ideas, then you come to absolute Christian science. Then you have your elements, then you can begin to calculate. You calculate ideas with ideas and have an infinite calculus of ideas. And little by little, then you will see that these ideas are not the origin of being, but that the synonymous terms are the origin of being. So go to the origin of being, to the synonymous terms, and begin to be aware of the nature of the capitalized terms. And as we do that, then little by little you will find out that they all belong to the one and only. And so you reach the level of science itself. Yeah? you see that there is a lot of value in considering any problem in the four levels? Well, if you don't, God help you. Now, let's take another category, perhaps again, as we have seen now the study, let's see how Jesus' life was, so to say, unfolding in this ascending way. So we take as a question Jesus' life. Let's consider how Jesus really was going through those levels, and with each step he would accentuate something different. Well, what is Jesus' life experience, life activity on the level of Christian Science? Yes.
He
was a healer, huh? Why this answer? You go to the category of Christian Science. Category of Christian Science is science brought down to humanity, the relationship to human, to the material, to evil. That relationship is healing. So he handled really evil through analysis, uncovering, and annihilation. He handled evil. So he was the healer. So he appeared first to the world as a healer. He didn't appear to the world as the ascended, but as a healer, men that walked around and could do the marvels and the wonders. And so he healed and saved. He solved negative problems. Was that all of his life? Or did he once touch, say, absolute Christian Science in his life? What would be one of the outstanding moments when he was touching absolute Christian Science? You go to the level of category of absolute Christian Science, which tell us something about the preventive art of Christian Science, about healing preventively, latent error, things like that. What was the outstanding? Sermon on the Mount. He was a teacher there. He didn't actually give a life, he didn't present himself as a life experience.
He said, I am the light of the world.
Yeah, I'm the light of the world, yeah. And so, I'm the resurrection, I'm the light of the world, yeah. Wouldn't you feel that his resurrection was of a different caliber than healing? That he proved there, for the first time, really, that death has no claim on him, that materiality had no claim on him, that he came out of it unchanged, untouched, so that he was really calculating in absolute values and remained absolutely untouched by the law of physics, by the law of biology, like feeding and drinking and air and so on, by the law of physics, rolling away the stone. He was absolutely untouched physically, bodily-wise. The loss of his blood didn't matter, all these things. It wasn't so much healing, see, but showing that the absolute identity of ourselves is always untouched by anything. So I guess that was the next stage, and he waited long enough to prove that, because he felt he first had to be sure within himself through healing that he can master a higher demonstration. But at that point he mastered it this way, especially after the resurrection, that he could go through the walls, he could overcome space and time. You see that all these claims could not hinder him. It was really the preventive art that no claim of time and space and matter could have any claim on him. So he was demonstrating really in absolute Christian Science, still being a body, but free from all the claims of the world. How can we see Jesus in divine science? I mean Jesus' life in divine science. We must be aware that he healed very often, not always, very often, on the level of divine science. As we said, he healed the multitudes. But his whole life, we are considering Jesus' whole life, that the accent was first that Jesus was a man that went around and healed. He was a healer. And afterwards he could show with the resurrection and with the time after the resurrection, really, that he could resurrect himself out of the whole mortal belief and was untouched by mortal beliefs. And then at the point of divine signs, what would we find there? He overcame time and space. That he did already with the time after the resurrection. You remember we said in the time of the resurrection, he overcame time and space because he would appear here and suddenly there. So space had no claim on him, time had no claim on him, walls had no claim on him, so matter had no claim on him. Yeah, but he still was a Jesus. He still was a corporeal Jesus. Now, at the point of divine signs, we see him as what? Demonstrating what?
The ascension.
The ascension. That was a complete new paradigm, namely to say, I don't have a body. I'm an individuality that does not need a body. Up to this time, he had a body. So, both level of Christian science as absolute and Christian science, Jesus had a body. He was had a mortal body, so to say. He walked around with a body like we are. But finally, at the ascension, he said, you know, man is an idea in God. I bring everything back to God. And so he ascended, and there was no more a body. We have really then a higher sense of Jesus' life as being an absolute spiritual identity with no material matter excluded. We had in divine science, matter is excluded. So he excluded his body. Yes. Do we have any indication of that individuality called Jesus at the point of science itself, on the level of science itself? No?
Be the Christ.
Be the Christ, yes. And how would that show itself forth? Still as Jesus. You see, the Christ, naturally, he was always the Christ. But the Christ is universal. That has not anything specifically to do with Jesus, but if we take Jesus as a specific individuality, do we have a form of his individuality on the level of science itself? Beg your
pardon? The chart.
The chart. Yeah. No. About Jesus himself, after his ascension, was that the end of it? Yeah, yeah.
Would that be the experience of Paul and John?
I think so, I think so. Did he not say that he remains to be an individuality after he has ascended? He himself said. He said, I shall always be with you until the end of the world. He didn't say, I'm finished. I go up to Jupiter or Mars. He said, no, I'm here. See, that's the level of science itself, he said. And he talked to us, and he said, and I will send you another comforter. I will send you signs. He said what he is going to do after he has disappeared. He didn't give the least impression that he's finished. He much more gave the impression that now he's real. Life starts after the ascension, that I will be always with you until the end of the world, and I will send you a new comforter. He appeared actually not only to Peter, to Paul. To Paul. Well, we have the Pentecostal experience, where the Spirit of Jesus was at work too. And so we have Jesus coming to St. John and say, look here, St. John, take your pen and write down what I dictate you. I'm here, I dictate you. And John said, this is the message from Jesus. You see, where he wrote that revelation, I don't know exactly, around about the year 90 or 100, that is about 70 years since the ascension of Jesus. So Jesus came and talked to him and said, I will show you what is to come. So you can see, you get there really the eternality of Jesus. I shall be with you all the time, and gives us a terrific sense that being is. So he proved that being is eternal. Yes. Okay. We have another few minutes, so we don't start with something else. We can take, for instance, the question of, let's take the question of law. That's perhaps also interesting. Mrs. Eddy, or Christian Science in general, or the science of being, has various aspects of law, or kind of law. What do we get in Christian Science? What is that law which Mrs. Eddy appeals to constantly when she's reasoning on the level of Christian Science? Yes? What kind of a law? And she explains that law, sorry?
Law of healing.
Law of healing, yes. Law of opposites, yeah. The law of cause and effect, huh? The causal law says, what causes disease? It's mortal mind that causes this. How can you heal that? Through another causal law. Start out with mind, fill your consciousness with mind, then you heal. It is, the law of cause and effect, or the causal law, that says if you start with this cause, you have that effect. And she explains, and that's why you say quite rightly it's a healing law, or because she explains both laws, the law of mortal mind and the law of divine mind, cause and effect. Did I make that clear? See, it's both ways. It's in the negative that she says, if the cause is mortal mind, the effect will be the same as mortal mind, it will be sickness. If the cause is mind, divine mind, and mind is the only cause, then the effect will be health. So through using those causal laws, the right causal laws against the wrong causal laws, you have the healing law. But when we come to absolute Christian Science, we get quite a different law. What kind of a law will we have to get if absolute Christian Science, you remind yourself the category, the category is the relationship of principle to ideas. So what is the law of principle to ideas? Is that the causal law? Not really, It is what kind of a law? The law of spontaneity, That law which just bang on comes without a preceding cause. You can see that on the level of Christian Science you have a horizontal law, A law that runs in time, a cause that leads to an effect. It is, so to say, a horizontal law, because there is first a cause and then afterwards, can you see, is an effect. Whereas the law of spontaneity is a vertical law. It happens bang on. It happens without a preceding cause. Cause and effect is one. And so you have the law of spontaneity. You see, what really Paul would call grace, said we live by grace, not by the law. With the law he meant that you have to do something and merit your reward. That was the old sense. That was the causal law, that if you behave well, you will get the reward. If you do not keep the law, you will be punished. That was the old law. And to that causal law, see, he came and said, we have found something new. You know, he was absolutely impressed by the Christ. That was, he wasn't impressed very much by Christianity. He was impressed by the Christ. That's why he doesn't relate any of Jesus' healings. Not one of them. He wasn't impressed by that. He could see there is something much bigger behind it. The Christ has come. I have to lead the people out of the Old Testament, out of the law, into the grace of God. That's he called the law spontaneity grace. At that time, one didn't know anything about the law of spontaneity. One did not even use a term. So he had to find one, and he said, that's grace. He said, you don't have to merit it. It pours down from heaven upon you. And it just pours down. No matter what you have done before, grace pours down on you. Can you see? No cause and effect. No being goody-goody, and then you go into hell, into heaven. Being baddy-baddy-baddy, down to hell you go. He just had that wonderful sense that every time, at every second, under every circumstances, there was the law of grace at work, God coming to us as a free gift. It was a gift, not something that we had to earn. Terrific, So he began to see that law of spontaneity under which we should live. We should constantly live under that law of grace, of spontaneity. Most of the Christian people living in a Christian era and Christian country, they are full of the sense of penalty, that they must be penalized for everything they do not right. Jesus never told that. Paul never. That's not Paul's theory. He said, you live by grace. You live by grace. So this is a terrific mutation that we should culture. You know, you should culture that consciously, that you get rid of that sense that you constantly accuse yourself, constantly think you will be punished for doing something, that because you didn't know rightly, you will be punished. Because you did something, do which was not good, you will be punished. It's all humbug. There is no other law at work but God coming to us. And that's the law of spontaneity, the law of grace, the law of the free gift. So live by grace, and not by the law of the works. If you come further down to a level of divine science, there you get even a higher law. I think there you get, you know, divine science. Oh, divine science, what's that? That's oneness. Within that oneness is operating, you know, that law of out of itself, through itself, as itself, back to itself. It's the cybernetic law, the self-operating cybernetic law that regulates itself all that needs to be regulated, that controls by itself everything that needs to be controlled. That is a self-organizing, self-regulating law. Terrific law. Not just bang, pouring down as the law of grace, but it's even more. It pours down and then corrects everything that needs to be corrected. So that finally you come to science itself, and there you, I guess, get just that point that the law is law as such. That there is nothing going on but lawfulness. That the whole of being is one lawfulness being. Nothing happens anymore by accident. So there is no more a falling away from grace, nor coming back to grace. Nothing happens by accident. Everything within being is a lawful being. Okay, that's it.